I'm very honored and pleased to have been asked to address this particular topic, and I commend you for having thought that this topic ought to be addressed in the church today. That bodes well for the future. Now, as soon as I heard the topic that I'd been assigned, naturally one casts about for this and that, and you can imagine my joy when I found in a book club the title, The Integrity Crisis, already written out. So I sent for it with alacrity, and well, you are, how is that one? Sins in haste and repents at leisure. But in looking through it, it's by Warren W. Wiersbe. And of course, there are many valid things in there that the author has to say. I certainly recommend it for a thoughtful reading and study. However, there is a fundamental problem here that brings out the rather basic dichotomy of Lutheran and Reformed. And that is that Wiersbe's whole treatment here takes off from these deplorable theatrics in the television industry with a religious patina, and therefore it thinks that the integrity crisis is to do with the fall of prominent leaders in the church. Well, yes, but fundamentally that leads him to what in those circles is more or less obvious, to a moralistic view of the integrity of the church. And that is deeply endemic to Calvinism. This is why, as my distinguished predecessor at this microphone has just said, in Calvinism, church discipline is the third mark of the church. Our Lutheran confessions, notably the very strict formula of Concord, is rather relaxed about church discipline, and in fact makes the point that you can't take away the title of true church from a church merely because it isn't practicing discipline. It recognizes with St. Augustine that you can't always practice it, and that's not the essential thing about the church anyhow. Augustine said if in his day every drunkard in North Africa were to be excommunicated, there'd be no church left. You can't do it if it'll simply decimate the church. Salus populi suprema lex. The salvation of the people is the supreme law. And in our church, therefore, in the evangelical church, as understood in the Augsburg Confession, discipline serves an entirely different function. It serves not the function of rescuing God's glory, lest he be besmirched by the unworthy lives of his followers and the church and God be embarrassed, but rather it serves the purpose of the shepherd through his sheep and his under-shepherds, seeking and going after the lost and making very sure, going that last step yet and having the whole congregation admonish the person so that he is under no illusion of paper membership in the church or something like that. It's a pastoral service of love. It is an apostolic, an evangelical thing. It is not something vindictive or something to safeguard God's honor that we've got to chop these people out now. No, we Lutherans cannot go with the sort of cure prescribed here, where there is rightly a stress on the meaning of integrity, also in the New Testament sense, where you get the term singleness of heart. The early Christians served him with joy and singleness of heart. Ehlert, in his booklet on the Lord's Supper today, points out how the Lutheran understanding of the words of institution simply takes the thing at face value. Therefore, it continues the singleness of heart, whereas the understanding that this is my body means basically this is not my body, where the basic problem is how to find some exegetical way of dealing with the words such as not directly to contradict them. What a dreadful problem to have. And that introduces, therefore, doubleness, from which we get the word doubt and the word duplicity. It is in nature, and this is the enormous blessing that we have inherited without any merit of our own from our forefathers, the enormous blessing of the Church of the Augsburg Confession, to take God at his word, to take his word at face value, and to interpret the appearances accordingly. It is in the nature of Calvinism to take the appearances at face value and reinterpret the word accordingly. And that leads fundamentally to duplicity and a doubleness and a doubtfulness in everything. Whereas the Church of the Augsburg Confession takes the straightforward understanding of things as they are. You remember how Luther distinguishes between faith and love. The integrity of the Church cannot possibly consist in the perfection, or anywhere near perfection, either of her clergy or her members. Only last week's collect reminds us of the bond of our sins which, by reason of our frailty, we have brought upon us. That frailty cannot bear the construction of any heavy weights to build an imposing structure of integrity on that foundation. The integrity of the Church, on the contrary, rests only on that which she receives from above, by her connection to Christ, her Lord and Bridegroom. So all the integrity is on that side. We participate only in it only by reception. And therefore Luther's complete qualitative break between faith and love, we've got to distinguish, he says, faith and love. Faith can tolerate no deviation. Doctrine is God's, doctrine is heaven, life is earth. Doctrine must be perfect and complete. Life is only very incomplete and always limps 1,000 paces behind. It can never catch up. And in the modern church, often this is reversed. And that, of course, exacerbates the integrity crisis. No, the integrity of the church must be judged by the integrity fundamentally of her proclamation. Nothing else will do. It is no good trying to judge the sincerity of this or that group, or the dedication, or take spiritual temperatures of this or that degree. All that is an exercise in futility and illusion. Rather, the one thing that gives the church her integrity is that which connects her to her Lord and Head, namely, the purely preached gospel and the rightly administered sacraments. On the latter I shall not speak much because we have another speaker on that particular topic. But that means that the fundamental thing in terms of which the church must be judged and must allow and demand herself to be judged is the question of truth. And there the modern church does not fare terribly well. Truth is very much today a sore spot. The modern church organization is rather geared not to pursue the truth and to discipline whatever steps out of bounds. Rather, the organization is geared to contain the damage, damage control if conflict should arise, and conflict management. Dr. Wallenberg, some months ago, gave a very profound analysis in a paper where he said that the tendency today is not to regard district presidents as supervisors who are responsible for the purity of doctrine and sacrament, but rather they are regarded as conflict managers. And if there arise false doctrine and offenses like that, then that's not up to the district president to deal with. That's up to the individual pastor who objects to it. And then the monkey is on his back. And so you have an accused and an accuser, and the bureaucracy sits above the conflict, containing the conflict, and controlling the damages somehow. That is not a healthy view of things. And of course, that isn't always what happens either. But that is a tendency built into our culture, one that we've got to recognize and identify. It's always easier, I think, if we illustrate principles with examples as far away from home as possible, then we can think about it objectively. And what could be farther away than the ELCA? with this charming picture here, the Lutheran of September 4th. The cover story is a slight modification, probably by that chap Ault, who wrote so many of our hymns. Here is the hymn, "Blessed be the glue that sticks." And here it is. What's the glue? I urge that you read that article. It's quite interesting. What's the glue? powerful symbols and mission goals can unite the ELCA and give members a sense of belonging to the new church. By, guess whom? Lyle Schaller, the same guru who advises our leadership as well, and I suppose a number of others. And what are the implications of this? The implications are brought out, I thought, quite nicely in a letter to the editor, which appeared later in the Lutheran of October 23rd. The Bishop Herbert Chilstrom thought in it that it was nice, it was turning a corner. And however, one of the members wrote in saying that Lyle Schaller's article was right on target, but the trouble is, as I view the broader scope of Lutheran confessional identity, I think anything from an Orthodox Missouri Synod view through liberation theology is viewed as acceptable Lutheran theology. I think this spectrum is too broad. Now, if that is the problem, you see, and undoubtedly he's right on target. The problem is that in theology, anything goes. There is no ELCA theology any more than there is an Anglican theology. Remember, there are three churches in the one Church of England: high and crazy, low and lazy, and broad and hazy. Not only one. And I think there are probably even more in the ELCA. But the thing is, when you have theological conflict, when you have schools of theology that range between some form of neo-orthodoxy, the passing of which Karl Broughton laments in the latest issue of the Australian Lutheran Theological Journal, and radical secular feminism that simply puts a female face on an atheistic substance, that is too broad a spectrum, because it includes everything within Christendom today. And if that is a problem, if the problem is no unity in the proclamation, then it's not simply a matter of not helping to stick these little gluey things on, these little tags here, that all these little slogans and so on. Actually, it makes matters worse, because it pretends to a reality which does not exist. Mind you, God, in his providence, of course, can make use of that, because if you take the gospel serious, and also especially laymen, when they take the gospel serious and don't understand the shenanigans and the gobbledygook of the clergy and the doublespeak of the clergy, but things can happen, and when the gospel is taken serious, it can get out of control, and out of that can come eventually a new confessional movement. So even that prescription could ultimately upset the apple cart. But for the moment, it creates a profoundly disturbing situation of an utter loss of integrity. Because when, for example, journals like Lutheran Forum are calling for clarification of theological issues and are calling for a humble stock-taking and a return to some basic confessional orientation, then to squelch all that inconvenient discussion and simply to begin clamoring about active missions, start two new missions every day and in this way gear everything to an activistic effort, is simply an attempt to evade the issue. It's not even pietism anymore, it's pragmatism. Pragmatism, cynicism. And that is the great threat that imperils the modern church when we imitate the sort of practice and politics of modern super corporations, where the pragmatically successful will squelch any inconvenient theoretical discussion. I remember at the time of our union in Australia, there were some voices that said, yes, we have differences, but we'll keep these people so busy with such active programs, there won't be time for these theological squabbles. Any thought like that is an attack on the church's integrity, the church's wholeness. And to mention in conclusion, two specifics. One, I don't know if Dr. Wenthy will deal with that, the real presence particularly, as a controversial issue. Is that in your program? Or? A little bit. Well, then I'll skip it. I'll take that as being taken up next. But the whole business of the confessional integrity at the confessional level and at the biblical level, the thing is given away. An Oxford professor of logic, Professor Michael Dummett, has challenged a prominent Jesuit philosopher who teaches at Marquette and who has said that it's becoming a consensus also in American Roman Catholic seminaries that Jesus never thought of himself as divine, never knew anything about the Trinity, never established sacraments, and never meant to found a church. In that case, says the professor of logic, in that case, we can know nothing about the Trinity, we cannot know him as divine, and then we can have no sacraments, and the church is a distinctively fraudulent institution. And it is wrong to have complicity with fraud. Now, the terrible crisis of integrity that exists in the mainline, and as Newhouse would say, sideline churches, is that you have the theologians believing one thing, the people in the pew really wanting to believe something else, and therefore the clergy not daring to say what they really believe, and therefore they have to clothe everything in pietistic evasions, and then you get double talk. Double talk, theological dishonesty, the inflation of theological terminology is today perhaps the greatest danger which imperils the integrity also of our church. And therefore, whatever you can do to insist on saying what one means and meaning what one says, in confessing the gospel as Christ has given it to us and as we have inherited it in our confessions, without this business of holding one's fingers crossed behind the back. And that God will bless. And out of that will arise a kind of confessional renewal which grants integrity on his terms, not on our terms, and regardless of our worthiness or unworthiness. Thank you very much.